4. And yet the Spanish Civil War anticipated and prepared the shape of the forces which were, within a few years of Franco's victory, to destroy fascism. It anticipated the politics of the Second World War, that unique alliance of national fronts ranging from patriotic conservatives to social revolutionaries for the defeat of the national enemy and simultaneously for social regeneration. For the Second World War was, for those on the winning side, not merely a struggle for military victory, but, even in Britain and the USA, for a better society. Nobody dreamed of a post-war return to 1939, or even to 1928 or to 1918, as statesmen after the First World War had dreamed of a return to the world of 1913. A British government under Winston Churchill committed itself in the midst of a desperate war to a comprehensive welfare state and full employment. It was no accident that the Beveridge Report, which recommended all these, came out in as black a year as any in Britain's desperate war, 1942. The post-war plans of the USA dealt only incidentally with the problem of how to make another Hitler impossible. The real intellectual efforts of the post-war planners were devoted to learning the lessons of the Great Slump and the 1930s so that these could not recur. As for the resistance movements in the countries defeated and occupied by the Axis, the inseparability of liberation and social revolution, or at least major transformation, went without saying. Moreover, throughout formerly occupied Europe, East and West, the same kinds of governments emerged from victory. Administrations of national union based on all the forces that had opposed fascism without ideological distinction. For the first and only time in history, communist ministers sat beside conservative, liberal or social democratic ministers in most European states, admittedly a situation not destined to last long. Even though a common threat drew them together, this astonishing unity of opposites, Roosevelt and Stalin, Churchill and the British Socialists, de Gaulle and the French Communists, would have been impossible without a certain slackening of hostilities and mutual suspicions between the champions and the adversaries of the October Revolution. The Spanish Civil War made this a great deal easier. Even anti-revolutionary governments could not forget that the Spanish government, under a liberal president and prime minister, had complete constitutional and moral legitimacy when it appealed for aid against its insurgent generals. Even those democratic statesmen who betrayed it, out of fear for their own skins, had a bad conscience. Both the Spanish government and, more to the point, the communists, who were increasingly influential in its affairs, insisted that social revolution was not their object, and indeed visibly did what they could to control and reverse it, to the horror of revolutionary enthusiasts. Revolution, both insisted, was not the issue. The defence of democracy was. The interesting point is that this was not mere opportunism, or, as the purists on the ultra-left thought, treason to the revolution. It reflected a deliberate shift from an insurrectionary to a gradualist, from a confrontational to a negotiating, even a parliamentary, way to power. In the light of the Spanish people's reaction to the coup, which was undoubtedly revolutionary, communists could now see how an essentially defensive tactic, imposed by the desperate situation of their movement after Hitler's accession to power, opened perspectives of advance, that is to say, a democracy of a new type, arising out of the imperatives of both wartime politics and economics. Landlords and capitalists who supported the rebels would lose their property, not as landlords and capitalists, but as traitors. The government would have to plan and take over the economy, not for reasons of ideology, but for the logic of war economies. Consequently, if victorious, such a democracy of a new type cannot but be the enemy of the conservative spirit. It provides a guarantee for the further economic and political conquests of the Spanish working people. The Comintern pamphlet of October 1936 thus described with considerable accuracy the shape of politics in the anti-fascist war of 1939 to 1945. This was to be a war waged in Europe by all-embracing people's or national front governments or resistance coalitions, which was waged by state-managed economies and ended in the occupied territories with massive advances in the public sector due to the expropriation of capitalists not as such, but as Germans or collaborators with the Germans. In several countries of Central and Eastern Europe, the road led directly from anti-fascism to a new democracy, dominated and eventually swallowed by the communists. But until the outbreak of the Cold War, the object of these post-war regimes was quite specifically not the immediate conversion to socialist systems or the abolition of political pluralism and private property. In Western countries, the net social and economic consequences of war and liberation were not very different, though the political conjuncture was. Social and economic reforms were introduced not, as after the First World War, in response to mass pressure and the fear of revolution, but by governments committed to them on principle, governments partly of the old reformist kind, like the Democrats in the USA, the Labour Party now in government in Britain, partly by parties of reform and national revival directly emerging from the various anti-fascist resistance movements. In short, the logic of the anti-fascist war led towards the left. 5. In 1936, and even more in 1939, these implications of the Spanish War seemed remote, even unreal. After almost a decade of apparently total failure for the Comintern's line of anti-fascist unity, Stalin erased it from his agenda, at least for the time being, and not only came to terms with Hitler, though both sides knew that this could not last, but even instructed the international movement to abandon the anti-fascist strategy, a senseless decision perhaps best explained by his proverbial aversion to even the slightest risks. Yet in 1941, the logic of the Comintern line came into its own. For as Germany invaded the USSR and brought the USA into the war, in short, as the struggle against fascism finally became a global war, the war became political as much as military. Internationally, it became an alliance between the capitalism of the USA and the communism of the Soviet Union. Within each country of Europe, but not at the time the world dependent on Western imperialism, it hoped to unite all who were ready to resist Germany or Italy, that is to say, to form a resistance coalition ranging across the political spectrum. Since all of belligerent Europe except Great Britain was occupied by the Axis powers, this war of the resistors was essentially one of civilians, or armed forces of former civilians, not recognised as such by the German and Italian armies, a savage struggle of partisans which imposed political choices on all. The history of European resistance movements is largely mythological, since, except to some extent in Germany itself, the legitimacy of post-war regimes and governments essentially rested on their resistance record. France is the extreme case, because there the governments after liberation lacked all real continuity with the French government of 1940, which had made peace and cooperated with the Germans, and because organised, let alone armed, resistance had been rather weak, at any rate until 1944, and popular support for it had been patchy. Post-war France was rebuilt by General de Gaulle on the basis of the myth that, essentially, the eternal France had never accepted defeat. As he himself put it, resistance was a bluff that came off. It was an act of policy that the only fighters in the Second World War commemorated on French war memorials today are resistance fighters and those who joined de Gaulle's forces. However, France is by no means the only case of a state built on the resistance mystique. Two things must be said about European resistance movements. First, their military importance, with the possible exception of Russia, was negligible before Italy withdrew from the war in 1943, and not decisive anywhere, except perhaps in parts of the Balkans. One must repeat that their major significance was political and moral. Thus, Italian public life was transformed after over 20 years of fascism, which had enjoyed considerable support, even among intellectuals, by the unusually impressive and widespread mobilisation of the resistance in 1943 to 1945, including an armed partisan movement in central and northern Italy of up to 100,000 combatants, with 45,000 dead. While Italians could thus put the memory of Mussolini's era behind them with a good conscience, Germans, who had remained solidly behind their government to the end, could not put a distance between themselves and the Nazi era of 1933 to 1945. Their internal resistors, a minority of communist militants, Prussian military conservatives, with a scattering of religious and liberal dissenters, were dead or emerged from concentration camps. Conversely, of course, support for fascism or collaboration with the occupier virtually removed the people concerned from public life for a generation after 1945, though the Cold War against communism found plenty of employment for such persons in the underworld or half-world of Western military and intelligence operations. The second observation about the resistance is that, for obvious reasons, though with one notable exception in Poland, its politics were skewed to the left. In each country, the fascist and radical right and conservatives, the local rich and others whose main terror was social revolution, tended to sympathise, or at least not to oppose, the Germans. So did a number of regionalist or lesser nationalist movements, themselves traditionally on the ideological right, some of which actually hoped to benefit from their collaboration, notably Flemish, Slovak and Croat nationalism. So, it should not be forgotten, did the profoundly and intransigently anti-communist elements in the Catholic Church and its armies of the conventionally pious, though church politics were far too complex to be simply classified as collaborationist anywhere. It follows that those from the political right who chose resistance were inevitably uncharacteristic of their political constituency. Winston Churchill and General de Gaulle were not typical members of their ideological families, though it must be said that for more than one visceral right-wing traditionalist of military instincts, a patriotism that did not defend the fatherland was unthinkable. This explains, if any special explanation is needed, the extraordinary prominence of the communists in the resistance movements, and consequently their startling political advance during the war. The European communist movements reached the peak of their influence in 1945 to 1947 for this reason, except in Germany, where they did not recover from the brutal decapitation of 1933 and the heroic but suicidal attempts at resistance in the next 3 years. Even in countries far from social revolution, like Belgium, Denmark and the Netherlands, communist parties scored 10 to 12% of the vote, a multiple of what they had ever scored before, forming the third or fourth largest blocs in their country's parliaments. In France, they emerged as the largest party of all in the 1945 elections, larger for the first time than their old rivals, the socialists. In Italy, their record was even more startling. A small, harried and notoriously unsuccessful band of illegal cadres before the war, they were actually threatened with dissolution by the Comintern in 1938, they emerged from 2 years of resistance as a mass party of 800,000 members, soon, 1946, to reach almost 2 million. As for the countries where the war against the Axis had been waged essentially by the armed internal resistance, Yugoslavia, Albania and Greece, the partisan forces had been dominated by the communists, so much so that the British government under Churchill, who lacked the slightest sympathy for communism, transferred its support and aid from the royalist Mikhailovich to the communist Tito when it became clear that one was incomparably more dangerous to the Germans than the other. The communists took to resistance not only because Lenin's vanguard party structure was designed to produce a force of disciplined and selfless cadres whose very purpose was efficient action, but because extreme situations such as illegality, repression and war were precisely what these bodies of professional revolutionaries had been designed for. Indeed, they alone had foreseen the possibility of resistance war. In this they differed from the mass socialist parties, which found it almost impossible to operate in the absence of the legality, elections, public meetings and the rest, which defined and determined their activities. Faced with a fascist takeover or German occupation, social democratic parties tended to go into hibernation, from which, in the best of cases, they emerged, like the German and Austrian ones, at the end of the dark era, with most of their old support and ready to resume politics. While not absent from the resistance, they were, for structural reasons, underrepresented. In the extreme case of Denmark, a social democratic government was actually in office when Germany occupied the country and remained in office throughout the war, though presumably lacking in sympathy for the Nazis. It took some years to recover from this episode. Two other characteristics helped the communists to prominence in the resistance: their internationalism and the passionate, quasi-millennial conviction with which they dedicated their lives to the cause. The first allowed them to mobilise men and women more open to the anti-fascist appeal than to any patriotic call. For example, in France, the Spanish Civil War refugees, who provided most of the armed partisan resistance in the southwest of that country, perhaps 12,000 fighters before D-Day. and the other refugees and working-class immigrants from 17 nations who, under the acronym MOI, Main d'œuvre immigrée, did some of the party's most dangerous work, such as the Manouchian group, Armenians and Polish Jews, which attacked German officers in Paris. The second generated that combination of bravery, self-sacrifice, and ruthlessness which impressed even the adversaries, and which that work of marvellous honesty, the Yugoslav Milovan Djilas's Wartime, brings out so vividly. The communists, in the opinion of a politically moderate historian, were among the bravest of the brave, and though their disciplined organisation gave them the best survival chances in prisons and concentration camps, their losses were heavy. Suspicion of the French CP, whose leadership was disliked even among other communists, could not entirely deny its claim to be le Parti des Fusilés, which had at least 15,000 of its militants executed by the enemy. Not surprisingly, they had a powerful appeal to brave men and women, especially the young, and perhaps especially in countries where mass support for the active resistance had been scarce, as in France or Czechoslovakia. They also appealed strongly to intellectuals, the group most readily mobilised under the banner of anti-fascism, and who formed the core of the non-party but generically left-wing resistance organisations. The love affair of French intellectuals with Marxism, the domination of Italian culture by people associated with the Communist Party, both of which lasted for a generation, were products of the resistance. Whether the intellectuals themselves launched themselves into resistance, like the leading post-war publisher who notes with pride that all members of his firm took up arms as partisans or became communist sympathisers because they or their families had not been actual resistors, they might even have been on the other side, they all felt the pull of the party. Except in their Balkan guerrilla strongholds, the communists made no attempt to establish revolutionary regimes. It is true that they were in no position to do so anywhere west of Trieste, even had they wanted to make a bid for power, but also that the USSR, to which their parties were utterly loyal, strongly discouraged such unilateral bids for power. The communist revolutions actually made, Yugoslavia, Albania, later China, were made against Stalin's advice. The Soviet view was that, both internationally and within each country, post-war politics should continue within the framework of the all-embracing anti-fascist alliance. That is to say, it looked forward to a long-term coexistence, or rather symbiosis, of capitalist and communist systems, and further social and political change, presumably occurring by shifts within the democracies of a new type, which would emerge out of the wartime coalitions. This optimistic scenario soon disappeared into the night of Cold War so completely that few remember that Stalin urged the Yugoslav communists to keep the monarchy, or that in 1945 British communists were opposed to the breakup of the Churchill wartime coalition, that is to say, to the electoral campaign which was to bring the Labour government to power. Nevertheless, there is no doubt that Stalin meant all this seriously and tried to prove it by dissolving the Comintern in 1943 and the Communist Party of the USA in 1944. Stalin's decision, expressed in the words of an American communist leader, that we will not raise the issue of socialism in such a form and manner as to endanger or weaken unity, made his intentions clear. For practical purposes, as dissident revolutionaries recognised, it was a permanent goodbye to world revolution. Socialism would be confined to the USSR and the area assigned by diplomatic negotiation as its zone of influence, that is to say, basically that occupied by the Red Army at the end of the war. Even within that zone of influence, it would remain an undefined prospect for the future rather than an immediate programme for the new people's democracies. History, which takes little notice of policy intentions, went another way, except in one respect. The division of the globe, or a large part of it, into two zones of influence, negotiated in 1944-1945, remained stable. Neither side overstepped the line dividing them more than momentarily for 30 years. Both withdrew from open confrontation, thus guaranteeing that Cold World wars never became hot ones. 6. Stalin's brief dream of post-war US-Soviet partnership did not actually strengthen the global alliance of liberal capitalism and communism against fascism. Rather, it demonstrated its strength and width. It was, of course, an alliance against a military threat, and one which would never have come into existence but for the series of Nazi Germany's aggressions, culminating in the invasion of the USSR and the declaration of war against the US. Nevertheless, the very nature of war confirmed the 1936 insights into the implications of the Spanish Civil War, the unity of military and civilian mobilization and social change. On the Allied side, more than on the fascist side, it was a war of reformers, partly because not even the most confident capitalist power could hope to win a long war without abandoning business as usual, partly because the very fact of the Second World War dramatized the failures of the interwar years, of which the failure to unite against the aggressors was merely one minor symptom. That victory and social hope went together is also clear from what we know of the development of public opinion in the belligerent or liberated countries in which there was freedom to express it, except, curiously enough, in the USA, where the years since 1936 saw a marginal erosion of the Democratic presidential vote, but a marked revival of the Republicans. This was a country dominated by its domestic concerns and far more remote from the sacrifices of war than any other. Where there were genuine elections, they showed a sharp shift to the left. The most dramatic case was the British, where the elections of 1945 defeated the universally loved and admired war leader Winston Churchill and brought to power the Labour Party, with a 50% increase in its vote. In the next 5 years, it presided over a period of unprecedented social reforms. Both the major parties had been equally involved in the war effort. The electorate chose the one which promised both victory and social transformation. The phenomenon was general in warring Western Europe, though neither its scale nor its radicalism should be exaggerated, as its public image tended to be by the temporary elimination of the former fascist or collaborationist right. The situation in the parts of Europe liberated by guerrilla revolution or the Red Army is more difficult to judge, if only because mass genocide, mass population displacement and mass expulsion or forced emigration made it impossible to compare the pre-war and post-war countries bearing their old names. Throughout this area, the bulk of the inhabitants of the countries invaded by the Axis saw themselves as its victims, with the exception of the politically divided Slovaks and Croats, who acquired nominally independent states under German auspices, the majority peoples in Germany's allied states, Hungary and Romania, and of course the large German diaspora. This did not mean that they sympathised with communist-inspired resistance movements, except perhaps for the Jews persecuted by everyone else, still less, except for the traditionally Russophile Balkan Slavs, with Russia. The Poles were overwhelmingly both anti-German and anti-Russian, not to mention anti-Semitic. The small Baltic peoples, occupied by the USSR in 1940, were both anti-Russian, anti-Semitic and pro-German, while they had the choice in 1941 to 1945. Neither communists nor resistance were to be found in Romania, and little enough in Hungary. On the other hand, both communism and pro-Russian sentiment were strong in Bulgaria, though resistance had been patchy. And in Czechoslovakia, the CP, always a mass party, emerged as the largest party by far in genuinely free elections. Soviet occupation soon made such political differences academic. Guerrilla victories are not plebiscites, but there is little doubt that most Yugoslavs welcomed the triumph of Tito's partisans, except the German minority, the supporters of the Croatian Ustashi regime, on whom the Serbs took savage revenge for earlier massacres, and a traditionalist core in Serbia, where Tito's movement, and consequently anti-German warfare, had never flourished. Greece remained proverbially divided, in spite of the refusal of Stalin to assist the Greek communist and pro-Red forces against the British who supported their opponents. Only experts in kinship studies would care to hazard a guess about the political sentiments of the Albanians after the communists triumphed. However, in all these countries, an era of massive social transformation was about to begin. Oddly enough, the USSR was, with the USA, the only belligerent country in which the war brought no significant social and institutional change. It began and ended the conflict under Joseph Stalin. However, it is clear that the war imposed enormous strains on the stability of the system, especially in the harshly repressed countryside. But for the ingrained belief of National Socialism in the Slavs as a race of subhuman helots, the German invaders could have won lasting support among many Soviet peoples. Conversely, the real foundation of Soviet victory was the patriotism of the majority nationality of the USSR, the Great Russians, always the core of the Red Army to which the Soviet regime appealed in its moment of crisis. Indeed, the Second World War became officially known in the USSR as the Great Patriotic War, and rightly so. 7. At this point, the historian must make a major leap to avoid falling into the pit of a purely Occidental analysis. For very little of what has been written in this chapter so far applies to the greater part of the globe. It is not quite irrelevant to the conflict between Japan and continental East Asia, since Japan, dominated by the politics of the ultra-nationalist right, was allied with Nazi Germany, and the main forces of resistance in China were the communists. It applies to some extent in Latin America, a great importer of fashionable European ideologies like fascism or communism, and especially to Mexico, reviving its great revolution in the 1930s under President Lázaro Cárdenas, 1934-1940, and passionately taking sides for the Spanish Republic in the Civil War. In fact, after its defeat, Mexico remained the only state which continued to recognize the Republic as the legitimate government of Spain. However, for most of Asia, Africa, and the Islamic world, fascism, whether as an ideology or as the policy of an aggressor state, was not and never became the main, let alone the only, enemy. This was imperialism or colonialism, and the imperialist powers were overwhelmingly the liberal democracies, Britain, France, the Netherlands, Belgium, and the USA. Moreover, all imperial powers, with the single exception of Japan, were white. Logically, the enemies of the imperial power were also potential allies in the fight for colonial liberation. Even Japan, which, as the Koreans, Taiwanese, Chinese, and others could tell, had its own ruthless brand of colonialism, could appeal to anti-colonial forces in Southeast and South Asia as a champion of non-whites against whites. The anti-imperial struggle and the anti-fascist struggle, therefore, tended to pull in opposite directions. Thus, Stalin's pact with the Germans in 1939, which disrupted the Western left, allowed Indian or Vietnamese communists to concentrate happily on opposing the British and French, whereas the German invasion of the USSR in 1941 forced them, as good communists, to put the defeat of the Axis first, that is to say, to put the liberation of their own countries much lower on the agenda. This was not merely unpopular, but strategically senseless at a time when the colonial empires of the West were at their most vulnerable, if not actually collapsing. And indeed, local leftists who did not feel bound by the iron hoops of Comintern loyalty exploited the opportunity. The Indian National Congress launched the Quit India movement in 1942, while the Bengali radical Subhas Bose recruited an Indian Liberation Army for the Japanese from among the Indian Army prisoners of war taken during the Lightning initial advances. Anti-colonial militants in Burma and Indonesia saw matters the same way. The reductio ad absurdum of this anti-colonialist logic was the attempt by an extremist Jewish fringe group in Palestine to negotiate with the Germans, via Damascus, then under the Vichy French, for help in liberating Palestine from the British, which they regarded as the top priority for Zionism. A militant of the group involved in this mission eventually became Prime Minister of Israel, Yitzhak Shamir. Such approaches evidently did not imply any ideological sympathy for fascism, though Nazi anti-Semitism might appeal to Palestinian Arabs at odds with Zionist settlers, and some groups in South Asia might recognize themselves in the superior Aryans of Nazi mythology. But these were special cases. What needs explaining is why, after all, anti-imperialism and the colonial liberation movements inclined overwhelmingly to the left, and thus found themselves, at least at the end of the war, converging with the global anti-fascist mobilization. The fundamental reason is that the Western left was the nursery of anti-imperialist theory and policies, and that support for colonial liberation movements came overwhelmingly from the international left, and especially, since the Bolsheviks' 1920 Congress of the Eastern Peoples in Baku, from the Comintern and the USSR. Moreover, the activists and future leaders of independence movements, who belonged chiefly to the Western educated elites of their countries, found themselves more at ease in the non-racist and anti-colonial milieu of local liberals, democrats, socialists, and communists than in any other when they came to their metropoles. They were, in any case, almost all modernizers, whom the nostalgic medievalist myths, Nazi ideology, and the racist exclusiveness of their theories reminded of just those communalist and tribalist tendencies, which in their opinion were symptoms of their country's backwardness, which were exploited by imperialism. In short, an alliance with the Axis, on the principle that my enemy's enemies are my friends, could only be tactical. Even in Southeast Asia, where Japanese rule was less repressive than the old colonialists and exercised by non-whites against whites, it could only have been short-lived, since Japan, quite apart from its pervasive racism, had no interest in liberating colonies as such. In fact, it was short-lived, because Japan was soon defeated. Fascism or the Axis nationalisms held no particular attraction. On the other hand, a man like Jawaharlal Nehru, who, unlike the communists, did not hesitate to launch himself into the Quit India Rebellion in 1942, the crisis year of the British Empire, never ceased to believe that a free India would build a socialist society and that the USSR would be an ally in this endeavour, perhaps even, with all qualifications, an example. That the leaders and spokesmen for colonial liberation were so often minorities, untypical of the population they set out to emancipate, actually made convergence with anti-fascism easier, for the bulk of the colonial populations were moved, or at least mobilizable, by feelings and ideas to which, but for its commitment to racial superiority, fascism might have made some appeal: traditionalism, religious and ethnic exclusiveness, a suspicion of the modern world. In fact, these sentiments were not yet mobilized to any substantial extent, or, if mobilized, they did not yet become politically dominant. Islamic mass mobilization did develop very strongly in the Muslim world between 1918 and 1945. Thus, Hassan al-Banna's Muslim Brotherhood, 1928, a fundamentalist movement strongly hostile to liberalism and communism, became the main standard-bearer of Egyptian mass grievances in the 1940s, and its potential affinities with the Axis ideologies were more than tactical, especially given its hostility to Zionism. Yet the movements and politicians which actually came to the top in Islamic countries, sometimes carried on the backs of the fundamentalist masses, were secular and modernizing. The Egyptian colonels who were to make the revolution of 1952 were emancipated intellectuals who had been in contact with the small Egyptian communist groups, whose leadership, incidentally, was largely Jewish. On the Indian subcontinent, Pakistan, a child of the 1930s and 1940s, has been correctly described as the program of secularized elites who were forced by the territorial disunity of the Muslim population and by competition with the Hindu majorities to call their political society Islamic rather than nationally separatist. In Syria, the running was made by the Ba'ath Party, founded in the 1940s by two Paris-educated schoolteachers who, with all their Arab mysticism, were ideologically anti-imperialist and socialist. The Syrian constitution contains no mention of Islam. Iraqi politics, until the Gulf War of 1991, was determined by various combinations of nationalist officers, communists, and Ba'athists, all devoted to Arab unity and socialism, at least in theory, but distinctly not to the law of the Quran. Both for local reasons and because the Algerian revolutionary movement had a wide mass base, not least among the large emigration of labourers to France, there was a strong Islamic element in the Algerian revolution. However, the revolutionaries specifically agreed in 1956 that theirs was a struggle to destroy an anachronistic colonization, but not a war of religion, and proposed to form a social and democratic republic, which became constitutionally a one-party socialist republic. Indeed, the period of anti-fascism is the only one in which actual communist parties acquired substantial support and influence within some parts of the Islamic world, notably in Syria, Iraq, and Iran. It was only much later that the secular and modernizing voices of political leadership were drowned and silenced by the mass politics of fundamentalist revival. In spite of their conflicts of interest, which were to re-emerge after the war, the anti-fascism of the developed Western countries and the anti-imperialism of their colonies found themselves converging towards what both envisaged as a post-war future of social transformation. The USSR and local communism helped to bridge the gap, since they meant anti-imperialism to one world, total commitment to victory to the other. However, unlike the European theatres of war, the non-European ones did not bring the communists major political triumphs, except in the special cases where, as in Europe, anti-fascism and national social liberation coincided, in China and Korea, where the colonialists were the Japanese, and in Indochina, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, where the immediate enemy of freedom remained the French, whose local administration had subordinated itself to the Japanese when these overran Southeast Asia. These were the countries where communism was destined to triumph in the post-war era under Mao, Kim Il-sung, and Ho Chi Minh. Elsewhere, the leaders of the states about to be decolonized came from movements generally of the left, but less hampered in 1941 to 1945 by the need to give the defeat of the Axis priority over all else. Still, even these could not but look at the world situation after the Axis defeat with some optimism. The two superpowers were no friends to the old colonialism, at least on paper. A known anti-colonialist party had come to power in the heart of the largest empire of all. The force and legitimacy of the old colonialism had been severely undermined. The chances for freedom seemed better than ever before. This proved to be the case, but not without some savage rearguard actions by the old empires. 8. So the defeat of the Axis, more precisely of Germany and Japan, left little grief behind, except in Germany and Japan itself, whose people had fought with stubborn loyalty and formidable efficiency to the last day. In the end, fascism had mobilized nothing outside its core countries, except a scattering of ideological minorities of the radical right, most of whom would have remained on the political fringes in their own countries, a few nationalist groups who expected to achieve their objects by a German alliance, and a lot of the flotsam and jetsam of war and conquest recruited into the savage auxiliary soldiery of the Nazi occupation. The Japanese mobilized nothing but, momentarily, a sympathy for yellow rather than white skins. The major appeal of European fascism, that it provided a safeguard against working-class movements, socialism, communism, and the godless devil's headquarters in Moscow that inspired them all, had won it a good deal of support among the conservative rich, though big business support was always pragmatic rather than principled. It was not an appeal that would outlive failure and defeat. In any case, the net effect of 12 years of National Socialism was that large parts of Europe now lay at the mercy of the Bolsheviks. So fascism dissolved like a clump of earth thrown into a river and virtually disappeared from the political scene for good, except in Italy, where a modest neo-fascist movement, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, honouring Mussolini, has a permanent presence in Italian politics. This was not due merely to the exclusion from politics of persons formerly prominent in fascist regimes, though by no means from the state services and from public life, and still less from economic life. It was not even due to the trauma of good Germans, and in a different way loyal Japanese, whose world collapsed in the physical and moral chaos of 1945, and for whom mere fidelity to their old beliefs was actually counterproductive. It stood in the way of adjusting themselves to a new, initially incomprehensible life under the occupying powers, who imposed their institutions and ways on them, who laid the rails along which their trains would henceforth necessarily have to roll. National Socialism had nothing to offer to the post-1945 German except memories. It is typical that in a strongly National Socialist part of Hitler's Germany, namely in Austria, which by a twist of international diplomacy found itself classified among the innocent rather than the guilty, post-war politics soon reverted to exactly what it had been before democracy was abolished in 1933, with the exception of a slight shift to the left. Fascism disappeared with the world crisis that had allowed it to emerge. It had never been, even in theory, a universal program or political project. On the other hand, anti-fascism, however heterogeneous and impermanent its mobilization, succeeded in uniting an extraordinary range of forces. What is more, this unity was not negative but positive and, in certain respects, lasting. Ideologically, it was based on the shared values and aspirations of the Enlightenment and the Age of Revolution. Progress by the application of reason and science, education and popular government, no inequalities based on birth or origin, societies looking to the future rather than the past. Some of these similarities existed purely on paper, though it is not entirely insignificant that political entities as remote from Western, or indeed any democracy as Mengistu's Ethiopia, Somalia before the fall of Siad Barre, Kim Il-sung's North Korea, Algeria and Communist East Germany, chose to give themselves the official title of Democratic or People's Popular Democratic Republic. It is a label which interwar fascist, authoritarian, and even traditional conservative regimes between the wars would have rejected with contempt. In other respects, common aspirations were not so remote from common reality. Western constitutional capitalism, communist systems, and the Third World were equally committed to equal rights for all races and both sexes. That is to say, they all fell short of the common target, but not in ways that systematically distinguished one lot from another. They were all secular states. More to the point, after 1945, they were virtually all states which deliberately and actively rejected the supremacy of the market and believed in the active management and planning of the economy by the state. Difficult though it might be to recall in the age of neoliberal economic theology, between the early 1940s and the 1970s, the most prestigious and formerly influential champions of complete market freedom, for example Friedrich von Hayek, saw themselves and their like as prophets in the wilderness, vainly warning a heedless Western capitalism that it was rushing along the road to serfdom. In fact, it was advancing into an era of economic miracles. Capitalist governments were convinced that only economic interventionism could prevent a return to the economic catastrophes between the wars and avoid the political dangers of people radicalized to the point of choosing communism as they had once chosen Hitler. Third world countries believed only public action could lift their economies out of backwardness and dependency. In the decolonized world, following the inspiration of the Soviet Union, they were to see the way forward as socialism. The Soviet Union and its newly extended family believed in nothing but central planning, and all three regions of the world advanced into the post-war world with the conviction that victory over the Axis, achieved by political mobilization and revolutionary policies, as well as by blood and iron, opened a new era of social transformation. In a sense, they were right. Never has the face of the globe and human life been so dramatically transformed as in the era which began under the mushroom clouds of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But as always, history took only marginal notice of human intentions, even those of the national decision-makers. The real social transformation was neither intended nor planned, and in any case, the first contingency they had to face was the almost immediate breakdown of the great anti-fascist alliance. As soon as there was no longer a fascism to unite against, capitalism and communism once again got ready to face each other as one another's mortal enemies.